Welcome back, Brendan.
I'm here.
We didn't really go anywhere. We're always here. We're wherever you're listening to us, I guess.
Like right? The NSA. Wait, no, not like the NSA.
The Not a Thing podcast, episode 163, coming to you on a whatever day you're listening to it, but we're recording it on a Thursday anyway. We're in good shape, I think, this week. Well, we have a few things to talk about, episode or things and not things wise, and then we're going to talk. I am so excited. I mean, we're not even talking about like the stuff that we're talking about. I really just want to talk the new James Bond movies. But we have other stuff. Don't worry, we'll get there. Spoiler alert for our own show, we're going to talk James Bond later in the episode.
You don't have to stop listening now. You know the drill.
We're going to start with the perennial favorite for the Not a Thing podcast, the Fuck the Police section. But in this case, it's sort of an update. Not exactly an update, but we've talked about in the past how a lot of police agencies have been using body cameras or moving to body cameras in the wake of a lot of public pressure and the controversies about how there've been like excessive force uses and stuff like that. And in Louisiana, there was a tragic case of a man and his son being shot at by the cops. And in a review of the body camera footage, it looked like the guy that was being shot at had his hands up and was complying. So they've charged they've suspended the two cops and charged them with I don't remember what degree murder. I think it was like second or third, which essentially means they were obviously trying to kill a person, but not necessarily with any kind of malice.
It was a second degree murder and attempted second degree murder.
Oh, because
they shot the father and killed the son.
Oh, that's right. God. It's especially messed up if I'm remembering correctly, because the prosecuting attorney general is the father of one of the cops. So he had to recuse himself from the trial. It's just a bad situation all around, but if there's anything to be taken from it, it's at least that the body cameras are being now used as part of the review process whenever there's any kind of officer-involved shooting, which I think was the point, to have that accountability kind of brought in. So hooray, that's at least a good thing. We've been talking about that for quite a while, so thankfully accountability is a thing, and will continue to be a thing, at least with a story like this. It's good to have kind of some coverage about it, so that's moving and grooving. I think that was in Louisiana, is that right?
Yes.
So it's just one agency, but it's certainly setting a precedent for other agencies around the country. So again, accountability, it's a thing. Please be accountable. I think it's in light of this, and there was, we didn't talk about it on the show, but there was the cop that was had like forcibly ejected a student from their seat and threw them across the room, and they were filmed by students in the classroom, and the cop ended up getting fired. So again, accountability, especially in the wake of excessive force, is a thing. I mean, we live in a culture of surveillance, and apparently it does go both ways. So at least there's some kind of positive aspect of cameras being essentially ubiquitous.
Yeah, it's not like these crimes weren't happening before.
Right.
Now they're just actually have the potential, at least, for some sort of justice.
Yeah. So we're not happy that these crimes are occurring. At least now, A, they are being documented, and then B, there are actual repercussions. These aren't being swept under the rug. These are fairly high profile, mostly because I think video is pretty unassailable, or at least it's a lot more it's a lot quicker to for people to identify with it than if it's just words on a page or reporting after the fact. I think, you know, if you can call it an upside, it's that there's a lot more of it's a lot easier to garner public kind of support for accountability in this case. So that's a thing. Moving from not a thing to what I think is a thing, Brennan, you can chime in about it, is a website I just found out about called Dumb Cuneiform. And Cuneiform, you may or may not know, is one of the oldest kind of writing styles. It predates hieroglyphics in use in like Mesopotamia and you know, the kingdoms of pre-Persia stuff, so Babylonia, you know, or Babylon, Assyria, that kind of thing. And it looks like little notches kind of in that they do into a in this case a clay tablet that is then kiln fired, but it's so weird. It just looks like little notches. They're barely shapes. Like and the way I understand it, it was primarily for like bookkeeping or record keeping. So a lot of it does look just like hash marks, like, you know, counting of things. But there is some amount what's the word? Not a vocabulary exactly, because it's done phonetically. Because it can be done phonetically, what this group does is they'll make the little tablet and send it to you. But I think the funny thing is the things that they are taking as the sources of these tablets are tweets. So you can tweet something and give them the link to that tweet, and they will look it up and then transliterate it, because they're not going to translate it. They're just going to take the things and then make the sounds, I guess, the phonemes that it would be phonetically, figure out what it's going to be, and then they carve it into this tablet and kiln fire it and send it to you. And the tablets, because they're only going past tweets that are 140 characters, they're pretty small. They look like the size of like half of an iPhone, which I think is hilarious, because it's like almost the size of the iPhone screen, and it's like, here's my tweet. I think it's a thing. I hope they do really well. I'm wondering how they'll do if I send them a haiku tweet, what they'll do with that.
Well, Alan, this is a rare instance where we're in disagreement on an issue. Dumb Cuneiform for dumb people. Not a thing.
Do you have anything specific against it, or is it just it's a silly concept?
I mean, it's just the thing. I don't even know how to explain it. I am baffled. Like, no one's gonna be able to read it.
That's true. That's true.
You don't even know if this is like the someone getting some sort of Chinese character tattoo, not knowing.
Oh right.
What it actually says. I mean, it's not a tattoo, but they could just be crank. This is the best scam in the history of scams.
Yeah, it would be a pretty good scam.
I mean, it's something. This seems like the kind of item that feeds into the consumerism and the, I dare say, hipsterism of social media.
No, that's this pretty is the good. Thing,
the only reason it exists is so you can tell somebody, look what I spent $20 on.
And then you would have to.
Oh, you don't use cuneiform on clay tablets? Oh, it's old. It's so old school.
It's literally the oldest form of writing. It's writing before writing existed.
Now, if you were to take people's tweets and translate them into cookies, there's a product.
Hmm. How would you? Then translate people
could
them
eat.
Into...
And then you could eat their tweets. You just copy it over onto a cookie.
Oh, I see what you mean. I see what you mean. Yeah, if they could bake it. Hmm. Okay. All right. I like this concept. See, we can always improve what stories we get. So that's a good one. I think
I don't get my writing from a pre-hieroglyphic writing system, and I don't live my life by a book that was written 3,500 years ago.
But cookies made from tweets, that might be a thing.
Or even if cuneiform cookies, that's got a nice ring to it.
Mm-hmm.
But then you still run into the, you don't know what it says.
Right, right.
I guess maybe I'm just too much of a cynic. I don't trust it.
Yeah, they really need to have kind of a back translation guide, at least, so you can look at it and then maybe work some of it backwards. I remember... this was years ago, but when they first opened the ride for the Indiana Jones ride at Disneyland, they knew the lines were going to be really long and they would take forever. And what they did was they gave you on your way in, they gave you this little card that had, kind of a fake writing system that they had made up. And they just made symbols, like 26 symbols, so one for each letter of the alphabet. And then they just, it was just on this card. So while you're waiting in line, there were these like fake hieroglyphics that you could see, and you look at the glyphs, and then you would translate it on the little card and have a laugh as you're walking through the ride. And that's really what this echoes for me. It's just like, you know, here's a little silly thing. And it's in code. I think, you know me in encryption, I think it's cool. It's kind of one-way encryption is the only kind of
it's
problem.
So encrypted no one can read it.
it's a form of it's a form of communication, which is probably not well, it's definitely not realistic. Like I was saying earlier, they're not translating it. It's so they're just transliterating it as best they can, kind of sound-wise, which probably doesn't match up at all. You know, to try and sound it back, it could all sorts of things. I mean, there are enough weird things in English that make things sound like other things that it would probably come back very strangely.
you know what this seems like to me? A Saturday Night Live sketch.
In that it starts out and maybe has promise and then kind of peters out and then goes way too long.
Exactly.
Well, speaking of things that have kind of outstayed their welcome, we talked about it a few weeks ago on the show about daily fantasy football and how it's really just betting and they should call it that, and it's not a thing, or at least the constant barrage of ads are not a thing. But I guess the New York Attorney General was fed up with the ads as well, because their department initiated an investigation, and I think you mentioned it. It was based around one of the, like, an employee of one, because there are two major players. It's like DraftKings and FanDuel, and someone from one of the the companies, like an employee of FanDuel, for example, like took the stats that they'd figured out at FanDuel and then placed a bet at DraftKings and then had like the highest payout that week. And then I think the corresponding also happened. Someone from the inside there was doing the betting. So it kind of casts light on like what's going on here exactly, or what information are they deriving that they're able to kind of win the bet, essentially have the highest kind of score that week. In amongst all of the investigation, the New York Attorney General agrees with the Not a Thing podcast and says, yeah, it's pretty much betting, and actually issued a cease and desist, an immediate cease and desist for the state of New York. So I think it's deserved. I think it certainly needs a little more scrutiny, or at least
regulation.
Yes, exactly. If nothing else, a little bit regulation would be good, because they were essentially running just like any other company, and
like insider trading.
They've put up a number of ads kind of since then saying that, you know, that the New York, it's unfortunate what New York is doing, and they're taking away like this avenue of fun between friends and family, which I don't think they're really doing. the point of the daily fantasy stuff is that you don't have that kind of long tie that you do with the regular season of fantasy football. That it's like this, you know, it's however many games it is, and all of the people that you've connected with for the draft and everything else, you lose all of that. In fact, the draft is not even a draft. If I'm remembering right with the thing, you there's no restrictions essentially. So you're just like picking from everybody. So you set up your team and then you let it go, and it's, you're really just kind of, I mean, the argument is that there's no skill involved. It's that you're picking all of the things and then letting the games play, and that's what the and then the number you're getting, or the score that you get, is based on that. And so you can think of the gameplay as the random number generator, and then you are skillfully picking the number that it might be or might land on, but it's not, I don't know. I think the skill is there's a continuum of skill versus luck in this. I think the amount of skill versus the amount of luck should be the determiner for if it's gambling or not. And I think, because that's undefined, that's why there's kind of a gray area about if it is or it isn't. So I think
there's more skill involved in a long-term league.
Right.
I mean, that by having it spread out over a whole season, that minimizes the amount of luck that is involved.
Well, it also, you're also changing it as the game goes. It's not a single one, like, point in time kind of thing. You're essentially looking at, it's not a coin flip, but it's closer to a coin flip in the Daily Fantasy League versus something where you're adjusting a thing over time and reacting to the system as it kind of evolves.
I would say the strongest argument that it is gambling is I'm going to Lake Tahoe this weekend to go gamble. That's the exact reason we're going there, is to gamble on football. no casino games, none of that stuff that just takes your money. You bet on football where it takes skill. But there are options in the parlays that you can do where you pick who's going to be the rushing leader, which is essentially the same thing as, or, you know, receiving leader, who's going to throw for the most touchdowns.
Mm-hmm.
You can pick individual player statistics to bet on.
Mm-hmm.
That's the same thing.
Yeah.
And I'm doing that in a sports book where they do gambling legally and regulated.
Yay. We think regulation is a thing. I think outright like big black and white rules are not a thing, but regulation, it's a thing.
People getting scammed is not a thing.
Well, we might have spoke too soon about that because we found out this week about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which by many, including the Electronic Frontier Foundation, is really scamming the not just the American public, but like the public at large, kind of globally. So the Trans-Pacific Partnership is essentially a set of agreements around trade. So it's what the participating nations will and won't do with respect to a bunch of things. So investing and electronic communication and trade, but a bunch of things around it too. So like copyrights and intellectual property are kind of tied up in there as well. And it's things like, well, we will not, one country will not impose its understanding of copyright on another country, or things like that to that effect. Or one country will not impede requests for information, or regarding like the users of a database, or things like that. And it's unfortunate because it's very long. I think there's 30 chapters altogether of all of the regulations. And so there's a lot of data, first of all. And second of all, there was not a lot of, or rather, there was no public comment on it. It was all done behind closed doors, you know, smoke-filled rooms, all of that kind of thing, to hammer this out. And it's pretty much an up or down whether it's going to be signed or not. And by all indications, it looks like the administration is in favor of it because of the trade implications that that are based into it. But the EFF, and we'll link their summary of it in the show notes, they did a quick write-up of all of the bits that were the most egregious about how this is in terms with the lens of personal data integrity and copyright and intellectual property. And usually, if not almost all the time when we mention the EFF, we tend to be on the same side of that understanding. So it's really kind of unfortunate about how it was put together, but definitely worth a look, if only to kind of figure out what diabolical schemes are going to be hatched out of this. One kind of thing that I remember was, it's interesting because it flies in the face of some existing regulations about how data sovereignty kinds of works. It's talking about how copyrights essentially are kind of ironclad and they last like a really long time, and that, you know, they're going to be respected, you know, from whatever member nations are involved and sign it. And it's, copyright is one of those things that you know, has not been really revisited in a digital kind of space, and with an understanding of how essentially whenever you read anything on the internet, you're essentially reading a copy of it, because it's not actually on the computer that your browser is in, but that technically is a copy, and because of that, it is subject to all sorts of weird regulations about how streaming is and how transmission of data is, and it wraps it up in a lot more than you might think. They're not any specific kind of outcomes. There's just a lot of potential kind of badness. So I think it's worth kind of looking at. But we picked it this week because it's in reading it, it reads like the plot of a James Bond movie, or at least one of the newer ones of
kind it's of actually the... similar to the plot of Spectre.
Yeah.
All these countries agreeing to do some things that may not be so great.
Yeah. So we're it's moving all
before we go to spoiler territory.
We're moving definitely over into spoiler territory. I mean, we can talk about Spectre, I think, very briefly, without spoiling anything, maybe. So to give people a chance to at least get our initial thoughts on it. I think it's a great movie. I think it's a great James Bond movie. I would actually rank it in the Daniel Craig kind of pantheon. I would rank it second behind Casino Royale and in front of Skyfall.
I would actually put it neck and neck with Casino Royale.
Oh, wow.
I really liked Casino Royale. Uh-huh. And it was very much a origin story type movie. They yeah. were really rebooting everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed that. But this was the first Daniel Craig movie that felt like a James Bond movie.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're let's I'm going to click the spoiler light on.
Wait, I can't see it.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
There it goes.
That's what we get for audio, picking an audio medium for show.
Should have a spoiler bell or something. A gong. Can we increase our gong budget?
Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think our gong budget was zero, and I will increase it to zero.
To one gong. I'll handle the gongs.
We'll add them in post.
Yeah.
We'll add them in post, maybe.
No, we won't.
But Spectre was good. I liked it. I think the thing I liked about it the most was just how you're right. It clearly this is a Bond kind of I mean it literally hits all of the Bond kind of tropes in this movie, right? If you think of Bond movies and you ask someone on the street that is a James Bond fan, like, you know, what are the things in a James Bond movie? And you name them, all of those things are in this movie.
Yep. It finally got all the things.
And I think, and I don't think they were done in a, I don't think it's done in a, like, we're just checking the boxes kind of way. I think it was still done very, very well. I mean, it fits really well as a movie. I mean, there's all of the things, you know, there's a bad guy, there's a kind of woman that's caught up in it, there's a personal connection to Bond that you know, there's gadgets. There's scenes on a train.
There's humor.
Yeah,
that's something that has been sorely missed.
Yeah, I think
in these movies, this actual James Bond style humor.
Yeah, I think they lightened this movie up a bunch. Than the past Daniel Craig films. So I actually watched all the Daniel Craig films on the Saturday before I saw it. Then I saw it on Sunday, pretty early in the morning. So everything was fresh. And I think watching them that way, I think it was actually really good because one of the things they did in the in Spectre, which I think maybe they didn't have to do, but it's fine that they did. Was yeah. that they essentially linked all of his films together, all of the Daniel Craig ones anyway. And I think that was it. I don't know. It felt a little forced, but I didn't dislike it. It was just
I think the reason they did it and why I'm okay with it. Mm-hmm. Is because they would have done that and like they would have been able to weave it into those movies a lot better, mm-hmm. but they didn't have the rights to Spectre as an organization or Blofeld as a character.
Yeah.
Like if they had had the rights, if McCleary didn't keep the rights, then they would have had, that would have been it from the beginning.
Yeah.
Like there's no reason not to. So that this is able to like retcon that into the proper canon. That's a very nerdy sentence to say, I realize, as it exited my mouth.
Well, I think that is an interesting thing too, because from a like if you're thinking of it as a James Bond like canon, if there is kind of an overarching one, I don't think there is any more after this film. The Daniel Craig films are their own kind of beast. There is kind of still a throwback aspect, and it's really just the Austin Martin.
Which, like, had some great gadgets.
Yeah.
And yeah, they destroyed it, but it lasted longer than any other car I think he's driven in all the movies.
But I think they, but by having really all of the, I think the major kinds of bits of things from the Ian Fleming books, it really sets Daniel Craig's movies off and puts it as a nice kind of package, the way that they've been put together, because you do end up getting all of the big pieces from those books. And I think it was just a good, stylish film. I think I do have kind of reservations about a few things. Like, I think the like when Madeline Swan walks into the dining car, it's like, I don't understand why they're so dressed up on this train. I'm not against it. I'm just
because it's a James Bond movie.
And
that's what I'm saying. This is a James Bond movie.
Yeah, yeah. And she's a little too complimentary, like during dinner. But it's like, whatever. I can suspend a little bit there, especially because the fight scene immediately following was so good.
Yeah, I mean that fight scene was one of many things that were throwbacks to original movies.
Yeah,
like that was just, you know, clearly from Russia with Love. You got that there. The opening sequence was very Live and Let Die.
Yep.
The Mountain Clinic, you've got Honor Majesty's Secret Service, which I'm glad they did and didn't do a complete reboot of On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Yeah, they easily could have. I mean, there are so many plot elements from this that.
But having seen that, like, that gives you the context of her character. The whole time I was watching it, I was waiting for her to die. Even in the end, I'm like, are they going to do it? Are they not going to do it? Like, that added suspense to it that maybe, I don't know, people who haven't seen those movies wouldn't get.
Yeah.
But it was, as a fan of the franchise, and I've seen every James Bond movie at least a couple times, it was nice. It was fan service that didn't feel like fan service.
Yeah. I think the only thing that I was maybe unhappy about was when Blofeld actually reveals himself as Blofeld, that it had a similar weight to it as when in Star Trek Into Darkness, when they reveal it's Khan. It's kind of it's fan service.
We all saw this coming.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's fan service that is only kind of the diehard fans are gonna get. And I think in especially with Star Trek Into Darkness, it was just they took that and then squandered it. But in Spectre, I don't think it's squandered. I think it's still, you know, it still has some promise as a thing. Like, they didn't kill Blofeld, so he's still there. And the thing in the books is he wasn't like necessarily a like nemesis for Bond. He was just kind of a bad guy that was there.
Became a nemesis for Bond.
Right.
He killed his wife.
Well, it's much more. It's much more of an arc, and it means a lot more now. I mean, the way that they've woven these movies together and really done them. The James Bond movies under Daniel Craig, or with Daniel Craig in them, actually have a story arc. Whereas almost all of the other James Bond movies are completely disconnected from each other.
It was in the last couple of years, I've gone back and rewatched all the movies. because of the James Bonding podcast that Matt Myra and Matt Gourley do. And going back and watching those movies, they're not good. They're not good. They're not well-made movies. They're pretty garbage and dated at this point.
Yeah.
But there's something about that. Watching them now as an adult who's seen thousands of movies is very different than watching it when you're a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And so you still have that nostalgia factor, but this actually, I think, kind of marries those two ideas of like, it has the nostalgia and it has the cheesiness, but it also is a well-made movie.
Yeah.
It looks really good.
Yeah. Yeah. That opening sequence with, just that whole thing had that, I mean, I think I could tell there were like two edit points that were kind of not obvious exactly, but it kind of took you out of it, that it's not like a very, very long continuous shot a la Raging Bull or Birdman. Actually, that's a better example that people will actually know. but yeah, it seems like one long continuous shot through most of that sequence, and it's done really well. The camera is not really in a boring position ever. There's always something kind of happening, and there's so many other things happening that you can only imagine how that was to kind of pull off. And it was I thought that was maybe my favorite shot of the movie.
That was really well done. Well, it's what's his name, Hoyt van Hoytema, the cinematographer. He did what was it, Interstellar and The Fighter. He pretty much all the, not all the, many of the good directors that are out there right now, this guy's done a movie for.
Okay. I thought Hinks was a great bad guy.
Yeah. Solid henchman, only gets one line in the whole movie.
Yeah.
But he communicated a lot with his eyes.
Yes, he did.
And
other,
his thumbs.
His other people's eyes. Yeah.
Yeah, other people's eyes. Yes, his eyes. I did think it was a little odd when Bond beds Sciarra's widow.
Oh, Monica Bellucci's character.
Yeah, no, that's a power move. You're going to pick someone up at a funeral.
Well, you know, the bereaved, what are you going to do, right?
Especially when you're the one that killed him.
Right. Right. That was maybe I mean it was great and she's gorgeous, so it was fine.
Everything's fine.
I remember hearing or maybe I just read it. It was an interview where someone was trying to say, you know, oh, it's interesting for Bond to be betting an older woman. And Daniel Craig, who was being interviewed, you know, quickly jumped in and said, oh, you mean someone his own age? Which I thought was great. It was great. Because
I really enjoyed when they were in the hotel room and he was drunk and the mouse came into the room.
Oh, yeah.
Interrogating a mouse. That's the kind of humor that a Bond movie should have.
Yeah.
Falling out of a building that's collapsing onto a couch. That's the kind of humor a Bond movie should have.
Right. It was very, I thought those were very Connery kind of moments. I think the weight of it, the weight of the movie is good. Like, you always feel like there's kind of something going on, and it never, I think it did kind of dawn on me how long the movie was when they got to the when they finally get to the complex where Spectre is run from.
Oh, where they go look at that space rock.
Yeah.
For no reason.
Yeah. he even says like, are we meant to be impressed?
But it's got the overly elaborate torture scene.
Yeah.
That, yeah, was really ineffective.
Right. I that's one of the scenes I definitely want to watch again. when because I'm going to see the movie again, but that was one of the scenes where I want to pay more attention to what he was saying about what it's supposed to do when that when the probe goes through, because I think I was just not paying attention enough or when that happened. I know there was another scene that was like that when they're on the train and he's kind of talking to Madeline Swann about the gun and how you should, you know, be comfortable with using a gun or at least holding it. And the reason that I remember being distracted about that was because the guy sitting behind me in the theater fell asleep and was snoring and I had to wake him up. Yeah. Not a thing. Not a thing, no. People. And then he walked out, which makes me think he must have snuck into the theater and was not watching it, but merely taking a nap.
I hope we make an action movie for that.
Yeah. Seriously, I don't...
I've only fallen asleep in a theater once, and that was in 127 hours. But that had nothing to do with the movie. I was very intoxicated.
Oh yeah, yeah. So I do want to watch it again. I think I do want to watch it again in a theater. I think that is actually a truer metric of how invested in a movie I am, because theater tickets are expensive. I mean, for the price of watching the movie and all of the other stuff associated with it, I can probably buy the movie when it comes out. But I do want
to be seen on the big screen.
Yeah, I think it worked really well. I think I actually liked because in I think all of the Daniel Craig movies, James Bond goes rogue, and I think it was funny that he takes the rest of MI6 with him in this movie.
Yeah, he wasn't going rogue. He was under orders from M.
It was nice to see more more Mallory M, like, doing stuff, carrying a gun, shooting it even.
He even got a good joke.
Yeah, yeah. I wish that Q had gotten had a little more meat to his escape. Like, I wish he had used a gadget to get out rather than just kind of, oh, there was a noise, and then he ran. It's like, okay, all right, fine. It's rare to see Q in the field and Q doing anything. I think is a treat, but I really think they should have given him like a smoke grenade or something.
No, this one gets my full recommendation. I put it in the top of the pantheon of Bond movies.
Mm-hmm. So, what? I mean, I don't even have to ask you. What is the rest of your Daniel Craig ranking? This and Casino Royale.
This is Casino Royale. Well, you have to put Skyfall above. I really like Quantum of Solace. I know I am in the minority. I think it is a decent sequel to Casino. It's all one big movie.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think it's a tight race in there. I think because I you know, seeing Quantum of Solace immediately after Casino Royale, it's great. It's actually very good. I think
it has a great opening. It's one of my favorite openings to a Bond movie.
Yeah.
The car chase in the beginning of that, and the fight with when they shoot the guy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Watch the movie. Give it a second chance. And you got to remember, when they made that movie, they didn't have a completed script. And then there was a writer's strike. So Daniel Craig and the director improvised a lot of the third act of that movie. So if you just watch like the first two acts, it's pretty darn good.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's really in the third act when it goes off the rails.
Well, there's also more. That's why they put like the big action set pieces in the end. You know.
Yeah, they're like, we're not going to write something good. Let's just blow some stuff up.
We're going to be flying and then dropping out of the sky and then walking for like 10 minutes.
I would say that the beginning of the movie up until the opera scene in Quantum of Solace is as good as any other Daniel Craig Bond movie.
Mm-hmm. That's good. That's good. That's good stuff.
I just gotta ignore that last part.
Yeah,
the last third of the movie or half of the movie.
We had both heard the song from the movie. What was it called? Writings on the Wall, by Sam Smith. Like out of context. And I was willing to give it a little bit of a shake to see, like, maybe in context it would be better. And I think it was a little bit better in context, but I didn't care for the opening credits thing, like at all.
This is the worst open. This is worse than the Jack White, was it Alicia Keys?
That was Quantum of Solace?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is one of the worst Bond openings
That's
ever.
The name of the song was A Better Way to Die.
Yes.
Yeah.
That makes more sense than this piece of garbage. Who's the guy who sings this piece of crap?
Sam Smith.
Sam Smith, not a thing.
Yeah.
Get your falsetto bullshit out of my James Bond movie.
I just want to watch the Skyfall intro again. I think that might be one of my favorite ones.
That's one of the best of all time.
Yeah, yeah.
That and Casino Royale was great too.
Interestingly, I think Casino Royale, that was the only one other than Dr. No to not have kind of naked women writhing around during the credits.
It was still good.
Whatever. It was still good. I liked it.
I really liked that they went back to the gun barrel sequence at the beginning of this movie.
I agree. Yeah, it needed that. I think that that helped set the tone, at least for me, having watched a lot more James Bond. It's like, this is a more straight ahead James Bond movie, and that's what we got. So that was good.
This is the movie I have been waiting for since they made the first one. As much as I enjoyed Skyfall and Quantum of Solace, this is the movie I've been wanting them to make, and they did, and I'm very happy with it.
So there's at least one more Bond movie in Daniel Craig's contract. I mean, I'm sure they're going to not make it, it won't be like an episodic Bond. It's definitely going to be linked to this one. Do you think it'll be like immediately following this movie?
Maybe not immediately, but I'm pretty sure they're going to kill her off in the beginning of that movie.
That's exactly what I thought.
They already did in the Bourne Identity movies.
Yeah.
But that was a while ago. People probably don't remember that. And to be fair, it's been done. Bond did it first.
Right.
So.
Right.
Yeah, no, she's going to die.
Yeah. Yeah, that's super.
It's going to be a bummer. I'm a big fan of hers. Lisa Doom. She's been in some good movies.
Yeah, but I think they by all appearances he leaves MI6 or at least it looks that way, or is on like super extended vacation or something. But I think, you know, they have a chance to, you know, bring it back and still keep the James Bond property alive as a thing where they can, you know, have a different actor and have a different arc if they want to or not and be episodic again. I
hope they do go back to that. I don't need this is a good arc on its own. I think they need to get back to episodic movies. You can use whoever you want.
But doing it as a kind of, we're using this arc as the reboot, I think is great.
Right.
Because it can set so much stuff up, or they can with this. And what they shouldn't do is wrap it all up in one.
Right. Which I was worried was going to happen. Yeah. And they didn't. They've set themselves up for another 50 years of making movies.
Yeah. James Bond. It's a thing. Continues to be a thing. James Bond will return as a thing.
This podcast will return in a week or so.
Hopefully. We're trying to kind of re-wrangle dates and stuff down so we're more regular. I know some folks have been kind of worried that our shows have been a little more irregular of late, but we're still recording. We're still happy to do it. If you would like to help make it more regular by being a guest on the show, because if you're a guest, we do our best to realign our schedules to fit you. So we're happy to have you on the air. Just let us know via all means necessary, and we'll get you on. It'll be a thing for sure. So, Brennan, I will talk to you and hopefully a guest maybe next week.
Till next time, Alan.